She gripped me harder. I'm not leaving you. I've got a plan.
Oh, God, no, please.
You're overwhelming me with your enthusiasm. I lowered my head to hers. Get to that car. You won't be able to miss it. I nudged her, but she stood there looking at me as I mouthed the word, go. She slowly backed away, the tears lining her face as she moved through the crowd to the gate. She stared at me one last time as if memorizing my face, and then she was gone. After any great challenge or crisis, the moment comes when your nerves stop twitching and you settle down to the new condition of things because you feel that any possibility of fresh horrors is used up. You have little choice but to stand back and take in the whole picture. When it's finally too late, and you acclimate yourself to that's it and there's nothing left to do, except maybe one thing, buy time. I turned back to face Bedard. All right, here I am. He played with the pistol, even going so far as to try and twirl it. Yes, you are. So do whatever it is you're going to do. Abuse me, torture me, or kill me, but be done with it, because I'm tired of you and your immorality, brutality, and insanity. You bore me. Looking down at me, he smiled and holstered the revolver. No, I'm not going to abuse you, torture you, or kill you. You see, Sheriff, I'm going to sell you. The crowd began cheering again, and I took the opportunity to move to the center of the arena, and when the noise died down, I scratched my neck in my best Will Rogers and looked up at him. I don't think you'll get very much. You underestimate your value. He gestured toward the well-heeled ringside, minus the leaking one that his henchmen had hauled away. Any one of these fine individuals will be happy to purchase your fate along with a number of others on the phones over here. I glanced toward the electronic banks and at the young people now seated there. You've got to be kidding. He looked genuinely surprised. No, not at all. You've made a number of enemies in your long tenure as a lawman. Some of them very powerful people with very long memories and, deep pockets. Rearing back, he roared into the microphone. Ladies and gentlemen, we have arrived somewhat abruptly at this evening's main event, the auctioning of Sheriff Walter Longmire. The crowd roared again, but for the life of me, I couldn't hear them anymore. Like the whirring of tires on an endless highway, the sound was there, but I could no longer hear it. I watched as Bedard drummed them up and even watched as the bidding began. I mildly wondered who were these people who wanted my life so badly. I think some of them even looked vaguely familiar. The swarthy one on the end, who might have been related to the drug dealer I'd killed in Philadelphia. The stalwart-looking one who might have been connected to the intelligence officer I'd caused to be killed in Vietnam. The woman who bore a striking resemblance to the rich man who'd faked his own death on the Powder River. Any of them could have been connected to the Dead Center Association, or to other individuals who had crossed paths with me that had unfortunately cost them their lives. Backing toward the platform where Bedard stood, I glanced up at all of them and at the earnest young people on the phones and listened to the bidding rise on my miserable carcass. It had moved so fast that Bedard had been forced to hand the mic over to the auctioneer. 6,400,000. Thrusting my hands back in my pockets, I turned and looked at the screaming people and wondered what could have brought them here in the first place. Some were, no doubt, innocents, drawn by the titular attractions of money and power. But the others? 6,500,000. It was a pity, really. But when you consider the beauty of the place, it was almost heartbreaking. I glanced around at the structure of the sale barn and thought about the monks and laborers who must have built it and the monastery. 6,600,000. I thought about the things I always thought of when confronted with such spectacular structures. I knew they were built as monuments to God, but I could never help but marvel at the men who had built such things. 6,700,000. 96 men died building the Hoover Dam, but contrary to popular belief, none were buried in the concrete. 96 men, and that was with relatively modern construction techniques.
6,800,000.
How many lives had been lost constructing the Great Wall of China, the pyramids of Giza, the Taj Mahal, the Colosseum, the Bagan Temples, Angkor Wat or Notre Dame Cathedral?
6,900,000.
I guess there were worse things at which you could sacrifice your life. Something that would live forever as a testament not only to God, but also to the beauty of the human mind and its ability to imagine, design, and construct such things.
7,000,000.
It is consistently amazing to me that people could disavow the one thing that separated us from so much of the natural world. The ability to think. The responsibility of asking why and what if.
7,100,000.
Never a big one for dogma. I believe that there's more divinity in an idea than in all the prayers in the world.
7,200,000.
But here I was, giving thanks to the fact that my granddaughter was safe and that my daughter was climbing into a pink 59 Cadillac convertible and speeding to safety.
7,300,000.
Pulling my fists from the pockets of my canvas jacket, I held them up to my mouth, biting on the two pins in my hand, slipping one on my little finger, and spitting the other into the sand. It was with a mild sense of satisfaction that I was thankful for those large hands, and more than anything else for what I lifted up in full display.
7,400,000.
Two ready-to-explode hand grenades. Chapter 12. It had grown remarkably quiet in the sale barn arena as I slowly turned, showing the crowd what was in my hands. Some of them realized what I held. The majority didn't, but all were very aware of the change of tone in the room. I smiled up at Bidart. He shook his head. "What do you think you are doing?" "Raising the bid." I stared at him. These looked to be two M67 fragmentation grenades. Now, the average man can throw these things about 100 feet, which means I can pretty much land them anywhere in this building. He continued to shake his head and gestured toward the gunmen who were now aiming at me. "And if we shoot you?" "It would have to be a very good shot, and besides, I still get at least one thrown. With all this composition B, these things have an injury radius of about 50 feet, and a kill radius of over 15, with steel fragments going out some 80 feet. So if these things in my hands go off..." I glanced around. "Everybody in this building's going to get a taste."
"Including you?"
"Yep. But that's the thing. I don't care. Everything I care about is out of your hands now. You no longer have any control over me." I took a few steps toward him. "Do you really think that I wouldn't give up my life to make sure that you and all these other people that wish me and mine harm were permanently removed?" He placed his hands on the railing. "I don't think you will do it. Not with all these innocent people in this arena." I glanced around. "You know, I'm having a hard time finding the innocent in this place." He shook his head some more and looked around at his men, probably searching for Culpepper as his go-to guy, but I didn't see him, and that was either very good or very bad. I took a deep breath. "Well, for lack of anything else, I suppose I'll save my own life."
"And walk out of here? Just like that?"
"Just like that." He smiled.
"You won't get very far, out there in the open."
"I'll take my chances." I looked behind me and was relieved to see that Culpepper was still missing. "Have your men open the gates and I'll just back out. What happens from there is between me and you." He gave me a good long stare, but without his chief crazy, I guess he wasn't willing to take the chance. He'd courted death when he had dragged himself out of the Powder River country with a chest full of lead, and I suppose he wasn't wild about the thought of rekindling the relationship. He made a barely perceptible gesture with his chin, and I listened as the gates squealed open. Careful not to trip over my own feet, I began backing out, still keeping a wary eye on the gunmen, strategically placed near all the exits. Some of them looked a little squirrely, but I didn't figure they'd do anything without Bidart's say-so. Everyone stayed clear, and I was about even with the doorway when I pitched one of the grenades back into the center of the arena. Erupting, the crowd started rushing in all directions, and even the gunmen seemed intent on saving their lives by vacating the place as quickly as possible. With a loud pop, having reached the limit of its 4-second M213 fuse, the grenade began filling the arena with a thick, white smoke, making it impossible to see anything. Pulling the remaining ring from my little finger, I threaded it back in the lever and deposited the remaining M67 back in my jacket pocket, truly thankful that Culpepper had been MIA, since any veteran of the recent wars would have immediately spotted the blue color on the handle of the smoke grenades. The majority of the people coughed and stumbled through the thick vapor, and I reached over and took the AK from the guard who still sat slumped on the bench where I'd left him. I had a few more tricks up my sleeves, but I was going to have to meter them out if I was going to survive the night. Flipping the safety off, I fired a long burst above the building, which caused even more chaos, as a lot of the audience fell back inside, thinking the war had begun. Taking off at a jog, I traced the layout of the tiny village in my mind and set out to the right, circling along the wall toward the monastery, where I had more work to do before seeing if I could get out with my hide intact. I ducked into the plaza and edged behind the giant puppets that had been used for the Day of the Dead parade, while three more gunmen ran from the monastery toward the sale barn and all the noise. Leading with the barrel of the Kalashnikov, I turned into the main entryway and looked down the halls, but there was nobody there. I thought briefly of returning to the radio room, but figured, with my limited knowledge, it would be a waste of time that I didn't have. Alexia was on my mind. I wasn't going to leave this place without her, not after the way she'd taken care of Katie. Never mind the prisoners who were in the same position as I had been and had just as good of a reason to get out and cause a little mayhem. I took the steps to the area below and threw open the first set of doors, but there was no one inside. I was beginning to think that anyone who had been down here must have been hauled away to the sale barn for the human auction, until I heard a couple of people yelling farther down the hall. I flung the door open to the first cell, but it was empty. I had turned to go when something struck me in the back of the head. I almost lost the grip on my weapon, but managed to re-aim. I stared at my assailant. Hayden? He gawked at me, his face attached, and perfectly fine. You? He reached out and grabbed my shoulders. I thought for sure you were dead, my friend. I thought they cut off your face. He looked confused. No, they brought a man into the cell and skinned his face to show me what they were going to do if I didn't talk. He thought about it. He had a goatee, not unlike my own. I rubbed my head where he'd hit me. I thought for sure you were dead. No, alive and relatively well, considering. He glanced past me through the open door. What's going on? I saved Katie. Wonderful. But I'm not so sure about us. Ah, but then all we have to do is escape. Ushering him back through the door, I explained about Bianca and Alonso. As far as I know, they blocked the road and are on their way down the mountain. I paused. She saved me. My sister? Yep, she saved me. She is an amazing woman. He shook his head and thought about how to get out. The roadblock will not hold Bidart for long, but if Bianca and Alonso get a good enough head start, they should be able to drive north from Torero and get back to our place. Then what? That is according to what direction we use. We will not be able to escape on that road. Bidart is sure to go that way after us. Only the insane will go by way of the canyon and the river, especially since I do not know of any horses or mules here. Mules are really the only form of transport that can navigate those trails. Then it's the canyon. But I'm wanting to inflict a little damage before we go. He followed as we continued to open the doors and release the men who remained. I assumed as much. With the help of the liberated prisoners, we were able to dump not only the crates full of drugs but also the cash from the windows at the end of the hall into the space behind the monastery, where the smell of the slag heaps from the sulfur mine and the methane from the decomposing bodies was strongest. Patting the last man on the shoulder, Aiden dismissed him, explaining that anywhere besides with us was probably safer, and we stood there in the hallway, alone. What good is all this going to do? Dumping the last crate through the window, I turned to look at him. I'm going to set it all on fire. His eyes widened. You are going to ignite the mines? I am. He looked out the window at the caves and the slag heaps that trailed down the rock face, the luminescent yellow of the sulfur even more visible at night. We have no idea what kind of damage that might do. Sulfur doesn't explode unless in a contained environment like those uninhabited caves. Otherwise, it'll just burn. And produce sulfur dioxide gas. Yep. but anybody who's interested should be able to move the blockade pretty quickly, and then they can all safely escape. And if Bidart and his men attempt to stay and retrieve their money and goods, they die. I looked out at the radiant cliffs. Only appropriate that the devil should choke to death on brimstone, don't you think? Genius. Smiling, he shook his head. I only hope the retainer wall is enough to contain the rock slide. In the meantime, we need to get out of here and to those mules, because I don't think they're going to react positively to all the pyrotechnics. With Aiden following, I worked my way back down the hall. I was unhappy to hear noises and shouting from the plaza, and rewarded the first gunman to come around the corner with the wooden butt of the AK. He wasn't completely out, so I threw him in one of the rooms and blocked the door. Collecting the Kalashnikov from the floor, I handed it to Aiden. Here, we can start up an Eastern Bloc gun shop back at your place. We'd made it to the end of the hallway when I heard the sound of a simulated electronic firefight. Glancing back at Aiden, I lifted a finger to my lips and then slowly pushed the door open to find Peter Lowry in his game chair, back to us as he decimated attacking soldiers on the screen. He had his headphones on, but the volume was so loud we could hear it from the hallway. Slowly I brought up the barrel of the 7.62x39mm and fired a few rounds. The large flat screen exploded with a great deal of flying glass and sparks as Lowry fell backward onto the floor, the space-age chair spilling him out at my feet as his headphones flew off. The gunfire continued, the sound system evidently not connected to the TV. I aimed at the computer tower and blew it apart with a few more rounds. Lowry started screaming, "Shit! Shit! Shit!" "Shut up." He slowly removed his arms from his face and looked up at me. "You're alive?" "That isn't the half of it." I reached down and grabbed him by the front of his shirt, along with some chest, and lifted him up to his unsteady feet. "Wait, wait!" Transferring my hand to his throat, I pulled him in close. "For what?" "I'm the one that helped you call the cops, remember?" "And sent them to a restaurant in Mexico City." "What?" "Culpepper said you gave them the coordinates for the taco garage or something." "What? Wait, no! Culpepper's full of shit, man! He wouldn't know the coordinates of his asshole if he didn't wipe it every day." He tried to dislodge my hand, but gave up as I spun him around and put him against the wall, lifting him till he was on tiptoe. "Look, the feds would know if I gave them the coordinates of the capital of Mexico, honest!" "Then where'd you send them?" He looked around, the panic writ broad across his face. "Here! I sent them here, goddammit!" "Why did you backtrack and rat us out?" His expression made it plain as he struggled with my hand some more. "So they wouldn't kill me, Jesus!" I turned to Aiden. "Do you believe him?" The doc nodded. "I think he's too scared to lie." "You think we can trust him?" "As long as we have the upper hand, yes." I turned back to the computer whiz. "You change sides again, and I'll cut your head off and put it on a stick. You got me?" He nodded, and I lowered him to the ground. "Do you have some other way of contacting the outside world?" "You mean besides the computer you just shot up?" "Yep." He reached down and pulled up a small, padded vinyl container and unzipped it, producing a smallish cell phone in a hard black case with yellow highlights. "Sonam XP. What good is that going to do if we don't have service?" "It's a sat phone. It'll work anywhere, almost."
"Almost?"
"Inmarsat doesn't work at the North and South Poles. But other than that, I don't know, sometimes it doesn't work and you have to turn it off and back on again like everything else. But as long as you have power and a clear view of the sky, all systems should be go." I took it from him and stared at its blatant simplicity. "How does it work?" "Like a cell phone."
"Calling the U.S.?
"Country code 011 and then 870 in the number."
"Charger?"
"Unless you're going to talk for more than 8 hours, you should be fine."
I nodded, stuffing the thing in my pocket.
"Now, where do they keep Alexia?"
"Who?"
"The Mexican woman who was taking care of my daughter." He glanced up. "Second floor."
I shoved him toward the door.
"Show me."
Massaging his throat, he croaked.
"What about me? Don't I get a gun?"
Aiden and I spoke simultaneously.
"No."
I pushed him out in front as we made the stairwell and moved up to the second floor where the hallway appeared empty. I glanced at Lowry and he pointed farther down the hallway to the door in the end.
"That one. They were keeping her in that one and the one next to it."
Hustling down the hall, I motioned for Aiden to wait at the stairwell just to make sure no one came up behind us. The accommodations were a little nicer on this floor, the doors replete with regular locks, and I noticed the key sticking out of the mechanism where Peter said they were keeping Alexia, which I found handy. I took the precaution of knocking on the door.
"Alexia, it's me, the sheriff."
There was no answer. I knocked louder. Alexei, it's me, Walt Longmire.
Sheriff.
Her voice was faint, but still discernible. I turned the key and pushed the door open, to find her on the floor beside a chair. Kneeling at her side, I turned her over, and could see that one eye was blackened and swollen to the point of being completely shut, and that the skin was broken at the bridge of her nose and at the corner of her mouth. The side of her forehead was scuffed and bleeding, where it looked as if she'd been kicked, and her nostrils were clogged with blood. Oh, Alexia.
It looked much worse than his.
Aiden had already returned from the next room with a few washcloths, dripping with water, and gently began cleaning her. Who did this to you? Struggling to enunciate, she spat out the words,
Culpepper. When they come to get Miss Kitty, I fight with them and knock him down in front of his men.
Oh, I bet he liked that.
She attempted a smile.
He is very angry.
Uh-huh. I helped her to sit up. Can you stand?
Yes, yes, but where is...
I steadied her as she struggled to her feet. Safe, and on her way out of town, where we should be getting. She squared her shoulders and planted her feet in the sensible shoes and made for the door like a dreadnought.
We go!
Glancing at the other two, I smiled, and we followed, finally overtaking her in the hallway where I moved to the front and started down the stairs toward the plaza, hoping with all my might that we'd run into Culpepper. I retraced the route I'd taken to get there, avoiding the crowds by staying along the walls of the square. We hung a sharp left before following the wall to the narrow street, a little ways behind the sale barn, and the small meadow where I hoped the mules were still grazing as if nothing had happened. Most of the people who had been at the auction were rushing toward the monastery and the main road, so I wasn't too worried about running into anybody in the dark, but things were calming down, and it was just a question of time before they started looking for us. When we turned the corner of an adjacent building, the four modes of transportation raised their heads to look at us, and I was never so happy to see a team of mules in my life. Lowry stopped dead and turned to look at us.
You've got to be kidding.
I nudged him forward with the barrel of my AK. What?
I thought you had a helicopter or something.
He stumbled forward, looking back at me.
Donkeys?
Mules, and if you hurt their feelings, you'll have to walk. Arriving at the animals, he glanced around.
I think I'd prefer it.
Turning to Aiden, I handed him and Alexia the leads and pointed toward the precipice where we'd met the patrol. You two go ahead, and I'll meet you at the rock outcropping on the ridge where we let the kid go. What are you going to do? I glanced at the wall and pulled the remaining grenade from my pocket, the darkened cliffs looking ominous and the smell of sulfur choking the air. Light this place up like the 4th of July.
Dia de los Muertos.
I sure hope not, but you'll have a ringside seat from up on that ridge. I patted his shoulder, and then gave Alexia a hug. I watched as Aiden nodded and started off with two of the mules and Lowry in tow. Alexia sat there on her mule.
I stay with you.
No. I gestured after the departing two who had paused on the trail looking back at us. Turning and handing her my rifle, I paused a moment to lean my head forward where we touched on the spot where she was undamaged. I cannot thank you enough for what you've done for me and my family. Lifting my face, I kissed her dark hair with a few threads of silver. Now let me help you up. And hang on to that mule. I don't think he's going to like what happens next. Watching as she caught up and all of them began threading their way on the trail, I started fussing with the fuse mechanism on the M67 and tried to remember the grenades we'd trained with back in Vietnam. The one I'd tossed in the arena had blown off a few sparks, but I wasn't sure if that would be enough to ignite the sulfur-laden overburden on the other side. I'd heard stories in Wyoming where the heat of a dirt bike exhaust had been enough to light up fields of the stuff, but I didn't want to take any chances. As I stepped up on the wall's footers, I thought of all the bodies that had been dumped on the other side and reassured myself that they were better off incinerated than lying there rotting. Adjusting the fuse to the shortest possible time, I was pretty sure that I'd get the maximum amount of spark. I looked back up the hill and could see in the periodic moonlight that Alexia, Aiden, and Lowry and the mules had reached the first cutback. And in a few minutes, would be safely out of harm's way. At least, I hoped. I went through my calculations and figured it would only take seconds for the blue flames to travel up the cliffs and hit the mines, at which point the trapped sulfur dioxide gas would bring at least part of the mountainside down in a monumental tidal wave of blue flame that would look like the wrath of an angry god. I looked again and was pretty sure I saw my friend's outlines in the full moon at the high point of the ridge, about to disappear by the rock outcropping nearly 900 yards away.
I pulled the pin on the M67 and turned back to the wall, just drawing my arm up and making to throw, when I heard the distinct sound of more than a half dozen fully automatic weapons being charged, the clacking noise echoing off the wall in front of me. Turning slowly, with the grenade still in my hand, I was greeted by Culpepper and eight of his closest gunmen, the pale, ferocious blue eye focusing on me from below the brim of my hat and above the iron sights of his M16 carbine.
"Hey, Sheriff! What are you up to?"
I shrugged, gesturing with the grenade. What would a party be without fireworks? He motioned for me to step down, which I didn't do, gesturing again with the grenade. "You don't mind if I'm careful with this?
What, you worried about smoking us to death?"
That's what I got for trying to use the same trick twice. He stepped forward, now only a couple of yards away, as the others fanned out.
"You the one that dumped all our stuff out the windows back at the monastery?"
Seemed like a good idea at the time.
"Yeah, well, the four dumbasses who were supposed to be guarding it have been maximally demoted."
He gestured with the gun again.
"Come on, get down."
I did, this time, figuring I didn't have many choices, as he lowered the weapon but still kept it aimed at me.
"So anything to say before I demote you?"
"Your boss isn't going to like that."
"Yeah, well, he doesn't get a vote anymore."